Hi, this is Bill Linicky for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. The podcast this week is a conversation with Myron Orfield, the director of the Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity at the University of Minnesota. Orfield has also written many books on public policy and regional governments. The books are pretty good, they're well illustrated, and have lots of useful information about how different cities around the country are split up and governed, and how they have different tax bases, and they're full of detail. Orfield has spent years studying how municipal fragmentation has led to persistent inequality, particularly focusing on the Twin Cities. He's made headlines a few months ago after publishing a study that called for the Metropolitan Council to build more affordable housing in the Twin Cities suburbs. After reading that, I really wanted to talk to him, so we sat down in his office on the West Bank of the U of M campus a few weeks back to talk about his recent report, the problem with the affordable housing industrial complex, as he calls it, and why the Twin Cities are more segregated now than they were in the 1960s. One other note, I've been taking some time off on the podcast lately, as you probably have noticed, to focus on some other projects, but I plan on doing maybe one or two more interviews until probably the end of May, and at that point I'm going to recommence a weekly schedule, so it'll be back to normal at that point. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with Myron Orfield, what's your official title, Myron? We're in your office here.
I'm a professor of law and the director of the Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity.
Yeah, and it's a kind of a, how long has this Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity existed?
Well, it was used to be called the Institute on Race and Poverty, but it's really been the same institute. We changed our name a couple years ago, and we've been around since 1993.
Okay.
So 20 years, about.
Yeah, and I have read a number of your books over the years. Let's just fill our listeners in on your background a little bit. You originally were a state legislator.
Yes, I was originally a state legislator and a lawyer, and was in the legislature for 12 years. I worked at the Brookings Institute for a while as a senior fellow.
And they're kind of a well-known national think tank.
Yeah, that's interested in. There's a section called the Metropolitan Planning Center, or the Metropolitan Policy Program, and I worked with them.
Huh. And then you served in the Minnesota House?
Yes, and the Senate.
Oh, okay. And then you stopped doing that.
Yeah. Well, I had been teaching here on a part-time basis. And, I had been teaching on and off, and I was about 40 years old, and I had to decide what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I was interested in both things, but I couldn't really do both things.
I was a page at the legislature, and I worked in the Legislative Reference Library for quite a while.
Okay.
I'm always impressed by the level of knowledge that legislators have about really deep policy issues. And yep. I guess if you go to meetings over and over again, where people give you presentations about whatever.
Yeah, you get it. It's a good education.
Yeah. So, but then you wrote a couple books, some of which I've read, American Metropolitics and a book called Region that's a little bit more recent.
Yes.
And these seem to me to be all about sort of regional fragmentation and the challenge that poses for U.S. cities in particular, right?
Yeah. I think it has to do with the challenges that regions face. I think racial segregation is the thing that I write a lot about, and that is a problem whether you have fragmentation or not, but fragmentation makes it a lot worse than it is without fragmentation. Everyone's segregated. The places that are highly fragmented tend to be a lot more segregated, and it tends to be more intractable.
Yeah. I guess the classic example is the 8 Mile Road wall
at Detroit,
Detroit. Yeah. But you know, you also don't have a lot of kind words about segregation in the Twin Cities.
No.
But before we jump to the Twin Cities in specific, let's just think about the U.S. cities in general. Mm-hmm. And why are they different from other countries? We have a more sort of fractured municipality structure here than a lot of other places.
You know, I'm not an expert on international law. I know a little bit. I know enough to be dangerous. And I think I know a little bit about France, a little bit about Germany, and a little bit about China and England. England is not has a lot of situations like ours, as is Germany. They're highly fragmented, but they do tend to finance services at a national level. Mm-hmm. So they tend to pay for a lot of things at the national level. So it doesn't matter as much what jurisdiction you live in, even though the jurisdictions are fragmented. The levels of services aren't so different. Although there's quite a bit of disparity in those systems, too, in school finance, which tends to be more locally supported in those places, too. So I think Europe is... There's more, much more national power. There is not the same concept of state sovereignty that we do. Legally, there's more, both formally and informally, local governments have more authority in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big problems, I mean, in a way, America and Americans really like having local control mm-hmm. and autonomy over things. We don't like the federal government telling us what to do in general. And
right.
It's been a long tradition in the U.S.
Right.
But, and so you might think in the abstract that having a lot of smaller cities or a lot of smaller governance is a good idea because you get to know the people that represent you. They know you.
Mm-hmm.
It's more responsive and flexible in theory, right?
Right.
But one of the problems, it seems to me, is that that you write about is the funding situation. So
yeah.
We rely on the property tax for almost all local government funding, right? Mm. And that's a big problem.
Well, we do for quite a bit, not all, but I mean a very large part, and particularly for the operation of cities. It's very important in the operation of cities, and it's quite important in the operation of schools, too.
And so I was looking in your book, Region, this map about different property tax bases in different cities around the metro area. Mm-hmm. How many cities are there in the metro area?
Within the 7-county metro, there's 187 cities that have land use planning powers or zoning powers.
187. That's a lot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a high number.
Yeah.
We're one of the more fragmented places, although there are places that are worse than we are.
Yeah, I bet there are.
Yeah.
I was just in Philadelphia. And
Philadelphia is one of them.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh, too, is really fragmented. Detroit, Chicago.
Yeah.
But we're up there.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at the city that I'm from, Mendota Heights, is one of the wealthier and sort of less stressed mm-hmm. places in the Twin Cities. And they have kind of an educated, affluent population, plus very low demand for certain services or whatever
right.
it is.
Right.
And so the property taxes there as a percentage of your house value is pretty low.
Comparatively, although in Minnesota we do a lot of sharing of property taxes. We have a thing called fiscal disparities where we share the commercial base. We also tax incomes fairly aggressively and redistribute that income tax to the school districts to try to equalize the differences.
Yeah.
So in Minnesota, even though we're quite fragmented, we do a lot on the tax side to even out those differences. They're still pretty big differences, but much less bad than they would be in Detroit or Chicago or your hometown, Philadelphia.
No, I'm from here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I was in Philadelphia, and I was amazed by the suburbanization of Philadelphia.
No, they don't equalize in Philadelphia the same way we do or in Cleveland or in Chicago. So it makes a lot more difference in a place like that than it does here, although it still makes a difference.
Yeah. So how much of a difference does that make? I'm kind of curious, because if you didn't have things like fiscal disparities and what are the other policies?
Local government aid and school aids.
LGA and a sort of a larger income tax sort of proportion, relatively speaking.
What would it be like?
Yeah, it would be...
Well, in places like Chicago, you know, you have the south side suburbs of Chicago, which are property poor, and they have, you know, extraordinarily high property taxes, which would probably be double or triple our property taxes that would produce... you know, 2/3 of the revenue per school that we do here locally. You'd also have places in Chicago, like the northern suburbs, Barrington Heights or Schaumburg or someplace like that, that could produce extraordinarily high levels of spending at half of our tax rate. So you'd have much bigger disparities. I think Chicago has 4-to-1 disparities in the tax rates and more than 2-to-1 disparities in school spending.
Okay, so ours are less than that.
Much better.
But
ours are much more compressed.
Every year when I see the high school hockey and basketball tournaments going on, I always think about this again, because that's when this sort of inequality across the school systems really hits the public consciousness. You know?
Yeah, I think there is inequality, but the two central cities spend more than most of the suburbs do per pupil.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that they have much more deep problems. I don't think spending is the way to deal with problems like segregation. You know, I think it's helpful and you got to do it, and it's almost a payment and reparation for the harms of segregation. But I think having racially integrated schools are a much more effective way to deal with the harms of racial segregation than just spending more money in separate, racially and socially separate schools. We spent, at periods of time, up to $15,000 or $16,000 per pupil in North Minneapolis, which is twice what they spend at Edina, or was twice at that time. So we've done a lot of redistribution in Minnesota that is trying to deal with this. We're very humane in that regard compared to other states. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's not enough. You know, some people say you need to spend $100,000 per pupil to make an all-black school equal to an all-white affluent school. And I have no idea whether that's true or not. I have no sense of being able to
understand.
Nobody
will ever know.
No one will ever know because it's beyond the political possibilities.
Yeah.
But here we've often spent much more in the poorest schools than we've spent in the most affluent, and that's quite unusual. Not very many states do things like that.
So what makes the Twin Cities sort of a distinctive place, or I guess, what is our metro area like versus some of these other ones around the country?
Very white. It's very affluent. It's very well-educated. The white people are extraordinarily well-educated and healthy and long-lived and prosperous and unlikely to go to prison. So there's a tremendous social capital in the white community. The black community is, the non-white community is poor and desperate like it is in most other parts of the country. And there's a huge disparity. The black and Latino community aren't worse off than they are in the rest of the country. They just don't share the white community's enormous well-being and prosperity. We have a state and a system of living that has been tremendously beneficial for the white population who have higher incomes, are more educated, live longer than their counterparts in other parts of the country, and enjoy access to lots of stuff.
Yeah, and it's funny. a lot of people forget about that, or we ignore this this fact. And it's come up a lot in the political discourse in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But then I wonder, how much can a city like Minneapolis do about this problem, and how much is it a regional problem? Like, to what extent is the municipal fragmentation at the root of this issue?
I think it's important, but I mean, I think we've also established really powerful structural antidotes to that here.
Yeah.
We have a Metropolitan Council that has the most powerful land use planning act in the country. And for a long time, or at least for 15 years, we were doing precisely the right things. We were building 3/4 of our low-income housing, or 70% of our low-income housing, in the whitest part of suburbia, in places like where you grew up.
Is actually some affordable housing.
Yeah, and no one else did that. And we kept our schools integrated at least a decade longer than any other region because of that program. We did a lot of fabulous things.
Who was governor at that point? Because Metropolitan Council is pretty much appointed by the governor.
Well, it was started, this initiative was started by the Met Council of Harold Levander, but really strongly shaped during the time that Wendell Anderson was governor and Al Halstead, who later became mayor of Minneapolis, was the Met Council chair. Mm-hmm. But they got a bunch. George Romney was a liberal Republican, and George Romney really wanted to implement the Fair Housing Act and tried to create far-reaching regulations. The Nixon administration rejected him, but allowed him to give a ton of money to a few pilot places to do this, and we were one of them. So we established really proactive civil rights rules for housing.
And that's Mitt Romney's dad. He was involved with HUD, right?
Yes, he was the secretary of HUD.
Yeah, I saw a picture.
And he was a very wonderful guy and a racial progressive and had a vision for a racially integrated society. But he didn't have a president that wanted to go as far as he did.
Huh. Well, I don't want to ask what happened to that family, but I saw a picture of George Romney sitting around planning the Cedar Riverside Plaza area once, and I that was interesting to me.
Yeah, which I'm not as big of a fan of that particular aspect.
I read your quotes about it.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, had it been able to be a mixed-income community, and I still think it should be a mixed-income community, it would be a lot better. But the idea of having a huge high-rise that's just poor people has never been a successful thing in any place in the United States.
Yeah, and this is about as successful as it gets right here.
Because
it's being rehabbed. It's not totally derelict. It's serving its purpose.
But many of these housing projects in Chicago were rehabbed at enormous expense over and over and over again before they were torn down.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I don't think I think segregation is a much deeper problem than the physical structures that encompass it.
So let's talk a little bit about affordable housing in particular. What's the Fair Housing Act, and tell me about that.
Fair Housing Act was a law that was passed in 1968. Walter Mondale was the chief author of it. And it was in response to, it was the last major effort of the coordinated civil rights community. There had been the It's the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and then the Fair Housing Act was the last piece of the puzzle and the hardest to pass. And it was passed in response to riots all over the country that occurred in the mid-60s. And also Martin Luther King's assassination probably pushed it finally over its final hurdle. And it said that agencies that are receiving federal funds have to use their leverage to try to shape a racially integrated society. And it's their obligation. It created really strong obligations in people that receive federal funds to use them in a way that promotes racial integration. And George Romney was the first secretary that implemented that act, and he was a very good guy, and he tried to create strong rules, but his president did not want to implement those strong rules, but allowed him to give some support to a few regions that were interested in taking up that challenge, and we were one, and we did the best job of it.
The Twin Cities was a test run for this?
Yeah, it was a test run for it. We created a policy called Met Council Policy 13, and later Met Council Policy 39. And I've written about this in articles. I wrote about it in an article. I think it was in the Fordham Urban Law Journal.
I missed that issue.
That's all right.
Normally I read it.
Yeah, it's okay. But I mean, there should be more written about it because they did such a wonderful job. And Ed Getz at the Humphrey School has written about it too.
Yeah. I don't want to pick that fight again with you and Ed.
Right.
I took a class with him.
Yeah. No, there's certain things we agree on and certain things we don't.
Yeah, and I want to get into that.
Sure.
But let's just talk about the reasons for segregation in housing. I was reading one of my favorite books to talk about this issue is the Sugru book about Detroit, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, which is really all about housing and the role that housing plays in kind of creating this sort of racial segregation, you know, and that's just one city, but I'm sure the same things were happening
there's
here.
Probably the best good book to read about how segregation caused is Doug Massey's book, America in Apartheid.
Yeah, that's another amazing book.
And it's a combination of public discrimination and private discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So, at first ghettos were created because when black people moved to big northern cities or southern cities to seek industrial jobs, their white neighbors confined them with violence, initially with riots and later with violence to neighborhoods. And if they stepped outside of those neighborhoods, they got beat up or killed. And if they bought a house in a white neighborhood, they were bombed. And this is not an overstatement. This was systematically happening throughout the United States as black people moved up into northern cities following the Industrial Revolution in the first part of the century. They were confined at first by physical violence to separate neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Then later, we figured out all sorts of really good legal tools to do this.
So you wrote about there are three causes, and the first one is the one I want to get at right now, which was in your article, exclusionary practices by affluent white neighbors, sellers, and rental agents.
Yeah, I think. Well, I was going to say, it's caused by institutional pressures. Segregation is caused when the government disproportionately builds low-income housing in poor neighborhoods. Segregation is caused when white neighborhoods prohibit the building of affordable housing in their neighborhoods. Segregation is caused when real estate agents show white people and dissuade them from living in integrated neighborhoods and steer black families or non-white families to those same neighborhoods. Segregation is caused when banks discriminate against non-white people by refusing to provide them credit on equal terms, giving them many less choices. Segregation is caused when school districts draw boundaries in a way that accentuates the residential segregation and makes it worse than it otherwise would be. And segregation is caused by all sorts of individual prejudice, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's the building of low-income housing, it's exclusionary zoning, it's discrimination by real estate agents, it's discrimination by banks.
How can we get to the bottom of this in this little conversation?
They're all these things are illegal. And we've dealt with them here effectively at one time.
So what are the sorts of legalistic sort of exclusionary practices? Are you talking about things like density, zoning, setbacks?
The concept of exclusionary zoning is defined in the law by a case called Mount Laurel. And that creates.
Is that in Philadelphia?
It's in the New Jersey side. Yeah.
Okay.
And Mount Laurel says that a community has an obligation to provide for its fair share of the region's need for affordable housing at 30%, 15%, 80% of the metro median. And if a city's zoning codes and development agreements and development practices prevent the market from achieving that fair share, they are illegal. And if the city does not take affirmative steps that it can within its power to achieve its fair share, it's in violation of Mount Laurel. So that's what fair share means. It means that you have to create a situation in your zoning codes, development agreements, and development practices that allow for the development of your fair share of the region's need for affordable housing. And that's part of the state law. The Land Use Planning Act imposes on every city in the region the responsibility to provide for their fair share of the region's need for affordable housing. So it's the law here, and it's based legally on that concept from the Mount Laurel case, which is a very famous case.
What year was that?
It was decided initially in 1974 and then made more muscular in the early 80s.
I like that I can ask you a question and like, and you'll know the answer.
Well, I'll tell you my answer. Some people, the Met Council doesn't agree with that. That's what fair share means right now, but they have in the past.
Well, like I remember seeing a chart of the Twin Cities affordable housing percentage in different cities, and the only one with a zero, or maybe there are more with a zero, but the one with the zero was Edina, and I like to make fun of Edina, but it's a fine place with fine people. It's nothing against the people. It's just that they don't have any affordable housing, and they built out at a time during kind of golf course era urbanism where that wasn't a thing.
Right. But now, I mean, interestingly enough, Edina and Minnetonka are applying for affordable housing right now, and the Met Council is turning them down, or the State Housing Finance Agency is turning them down so they can put it in Frogtown or in Phillips, because they think that's a better place for it to go. So I began my career really fighting with the Edinas and the Minnetonkas of the world, and I think they had a long way to go, but I think they've become better since that time and become more inclusive. I think right now we're dealing with the other piece of segregation is the desire of the central cities and of community development organizations to keep all of the housing resources in poor neighborhoods. And I think that's another part of the problem.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of being broad, but you said there were three sort of issues in one of your paragraphs that I was reading earlier.
Yeah.
Exclusionary practices and steering and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The second one would be banks and lenders and how they are a problem. The third one is this public agency situation where
they're building a disproportionate share of affordable housing in poor segregated neighborhoods.
Yeah, so in your chart, 25% of the population of the Twin Cities is in Minneapolis and St. Paul proper, versus 75% in the suburbs.
Right.
Now, I spend 99% of my time in Minneapolis and St. Paul proper, so it's easy for me to forget that there are places all around us with lots of cul-de-sacs and things.
Right.
Well,
and it's even worse than that because 12% of the region lives in what we call RCAPs. Regionally concentrated areas of poverty.
Okay.
And these are 12% of the region's population, and they have 60% of our subsidized housing. And so, like in Minneapolis, I live in Linden Hills, which it might as well be Edina.
Yes, it might as well be.
Yeah. And it doesn't have any affordable housing.
Well, at least you're on the number 6 bus line.
Right. And I mean, Linden Hills pays taxes to support poor people in other parts of the city. But it's segregated, and every level of government has made it so. And it used to be, when the Met Council was enforcing Policy 1339, they not only required Eden Prairie and Minnetonka Heights to build affordable housing, they required Linden Hills to do it too. And the little bit of affordable housing that Linden Hills has was because of the Fair Housing Act, when people took it seriously.
So in Linden Hills, they actually have like 2 or 3-story apartment buildings around the Linden Corner area.
Yeah, they've got some.
If you walk around there, there is density to a degree.
Yeah, there is some density there.
I doubt how affordable it is.
No, there's a few affordable housing units. There's some scattered site units that were created in the scattered site program, and there are some project-based Section 8 units, and there are a few tax credit units, but very little, you know, much less than it should have.
So you were saying that there's kind of a change been happening in the last 10 years or so in terms of suburbs asking for affordable housing.
And I think particularly since the Great Recession. And it's a situation that, you know, part of it is I think that they have become better and more sensitive to this, believe it or not. This debate, I think, has...
That's hard to believe. Yeah. Why is that change? I guess the economy is what you're saying.
Well, no, I think that they, because we fought about it and because they weren't bad people, I think that a lot of them were persuaded that they had to do more. And I think that fighting about things sometimes is good. You know, I think we don't fight enough about things.
That's not very Minnesota of
you. No. But I think, on the other hand, I think since the Great Recession, the rental market has become king, and the single-family home market's not strong.
And it's really strapped.
It's strapped. And the rental market, these developments, even in the wealthy suburbs, the tax credit units help the deals happen. The deals are still hard to finance, and if you have a few affordable units and then some subsidies, you can make deals happen. So there's economic incentives for these white suburbs to do this because they need it. And this is going to disappear when the housing market recovers. But I do think they're better than they were. They're not good, but they're better. suburban communities have become much more sensitized to the issues of segregation than the low-income housing developers in the core, who reject the idea of integration categorically.
So your argument is basically, it seems to me, that we should be putting 3/4 of our affordable housing in the suburbs and 25% in the city or something like that.
Yeah, I think that the Fair Housing Act requires that 50% plus 0.001 be built in a way that is pro-integrative. So I think the law requires that half of the units, that when we spend the money, we have to be doing more integration than perpetuation of segregation.
Who makes the decision? What government agency or body is deciding where to put these things?
It's a combination of the Met Council and the State Housing Finance Agency.
Okay.
They are together. And the State Housing Finance Agency has a bigger role. They have a thing called the Qualified Allocation Plan, and they have a point system. And they reward, when people apply for affordable housing, they reward it points on the basis of its characteristics. And the way that I analyze the QAP in the comments that I've sent to the agency, you get 150 points for building a unit in a poor segregated neighborhood, but only 10 in a white affluent neighborhood. Hmm. And I think it should be the opposite.
Yeah. So what's the rationale behind that? I know one of the issues is access to transit, right?
Yes, but 70%+ of people that live in government-supported subsidized housing have cars, and virtually all of the unfilled entry-level jobs are in the outer-edge suburbs. Mm-hmm. There's lots of entry-level jobs in the core, but there's lots of competition for them. And there's lots of new jobs in the central cities, but most of those new jobs are not, they don't match the skill sets of people that live in depressed neighborhoods. The jobs that are going unfilled are at the edge of the region and beyond transit. And this is where affordable housing should be if you're trying to get people some economic opportunity. And most people that live in subsidized housing have cars. Now, that I wish that weren't the case. I wish I rode a bus everywhere.
I wish you did too, Byron.
Yeah. And I'm going to try to do better. I try to ride my bike in the summer. But we live in a pretty spread out place, and we can't. I think when we say we have to build affordable housing on transit, it says we have to build it in segregated neighborhoods.
Yeah, it kind of does.
It does.
Because the transit potential in most suburban cities is so small.
Yeah, and there's very, very few places that are well served by transit that have good schools that are affluent. Linden Hills would be a perfect place to build affordable housing.
I'll let you tackle that one.
Yeah. But I mean, there's, you know, Mack Groveland, you know, Edina, they're not too well served by transit either. But anyway, I think transit should be better. When I was in the legislature, I supported every kind of transit that ever existed. You know. And was a vigorous proponent of it.
Yeah.
But I don't think you should force affordable housing to be locked to transit, because most of those neighborhoods are neighborhoods that have zero opportunity for kids.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so you just said the word kids. And so what is the role of the school system in all this?
Housing Act requires agencies to evaluate whether their actions help the school system be integrated. And one of the reasons you can't build all the low-income housing in a poor neighborhood is it segregates the schools in addition to segregating the neighborhoods.
I remember hearing that our schools are more segregated now than they were before Brown was passed.
Yeah. We were a wonderful place, you know, for a long time. We didn't have a single racially segregated school till 1991. And people used to look at the Twin Cities and they'd say, is this a part of Sweden? You know, is this a different country? Because there was no other metropolitan area in the country that was close to our size and scale and diversity that didn't have a single segregated school. They thought we were just from a different planet. Last year we have 150.
Is that because our sort of core city neighborhoods stayed sort of working class for a longer time than a lot of other cities?
It was because of the Met Council's strong efforts for 15 years, and it was also because the federal courts didn't allow our schools to be segregated. It was a combination of both those two things. It was civil rights law that did it.
Oh, really?
Yep.
See, I always want to blame culture or give credit to culture.
I think it didn't hurt that
we were... You like giving credit to lawyers.
Well, I think that we were really white, and that makes it easier.
Yeah,
places that are really white... But there were other really white places that had segregated schools, and we didn't. Portland, Oregon had segregated schools. Seattle, Washington did. We didn't. Now they have half as many segregated schools as we do.
So I'm thinking about my high school in Mendota Heights.
Yeah.
Also, it was a West St. Paul. The school district crossed civic boundaries, which was great because... We had a far more diverse group of people than we would have otherwise.
Yeah.
But there was one black kid and one Latino kid in my year, and now it's like a third Latino Hispanic population in the school because the neighborhood's changed a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm curious. That sort of seems to fly in the face of what you're saying.
That's good. I mean, the inner suburbs are becoming diverse, but the outer suburbs are still very white. And, you know, when I was a kid, I went to Washburn, which was integrated by court order, and it became a third non-white when I went there because of the courts. You know, then later became 80% non-white. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a kid, when I graduated from high school, Minneapolis was 25% non-white. Now it's 80% non-white.
City as a whole?
No, the school district.
Okay. The school district.
Yeah. Wow. 80% non-white and poor. It's twice as poor and twice as segregated as its racial counterparts in Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington.
The whole Minneapolis school district is 80% non-white.
78% non-white.
That's really a lot higher than I would have imagined.
And had we continued to build our affordable housing in the way that we did for 15 years, it would be the opposite. It would be 75% white, and the region would be still integrated. But we decided not to do that in 1986. We decided to stop.
So what happened in 1986?
The tax credit came in, the low-income housing tax credit came in, and the central cities and housing developers in the central cities got the legislature to dedicate most of those units to poor neighborhoods by statute. And the suburbs, which had been building affordable housing units and never really liked it but did it, said, fine, if you want it, you can have it back. And then we just embarked on, you know, we turned around. We had a fabulous system, and we turned backwards and built ghettos.
So you're kind of saying there's a affordable housing development industrial complex.
I think so, definitely.
That's something that most people don't think about.
Yeah, I didn't think about it for years. It took me 15 years to come to that conclusion. But every effort I made, I fought for fair housing in the legislature all the time. I was there for 12 years, and they always opposed everything I did. And, you know, they always were against anything that went to the suburbs. You know, and they always wanted to sue the city of Minneapolis and organize their interest groups to get Minneapolis to do things, but they had no interest in the suburbs at all.
So what's the big, the schools being really substandard is one big cost, right?
Yeah, that's a big cost.
Racial segregation in general.
What else?
If there was equality, it wouldn't be bad.
No, but I mean...
sound like a 50s
Yeah, well, if there was equality, there wouldn't be any segregation. But I mean, what happens when a neighborhood becomes non-white? Banks withdraw fundamentally. They shouldn't. It's illegal, but they do. Mm-hmm. When banks withdraw, it's almost impossible to keep a neighborhood stable. Middle-class families of all races want to go to racially and socially integrated schools. And when the middle class seek that, they leave everyone else behind. When you leave everyone else behind in a neighborhood that has no investment, and you leave people that have no mobility, you're going to have a very predictable outcome. You're going to have redlining and disinvestment and abandonment. You're going to have high crime rates. You're going to have terrible public health. You're going to have a public school system that sends kids to prison and not to college. And that happens everywhere where this happens. There's no place that's avoided that outcome. There's not a single place in the United States that has allowed a ghetto to be created and hasn't done that to the neighborhoods, to the families, to the infrastructure of the city. It's never been positive.
Yeah,
and there's never been an integrated neighborhood anywhere in the United States that hasn't been stable, that hasn't had private investment, where the kids haven't done well in school, by and large, and where that was a place of opportunity that launched people into better lives.
So there are two developments that you picked on a lot in your report and in a paper, which were I call it the Yogurt Factory building, the old home at Western and University. That's right near where I used to live.
Yep.
And then the other one is the Portland Franklin spot.
Right.
So why are those problems?
Well, I don't think they're problems. You know what I think of community development sort of as, you know, like palliative cancer care. You know, you're dealing with a neighborhood that has problems, and you're making its life better as it continues to decline. And I think that's what these developments do. You know, if you didn't have them, there might be more abandonment, there might be more trouble. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what's happening, nothing really has changed in those neighborhoods. All the kids in the school that live in those neighborhoods are going to end up in jail. That go to, you know, they're not going to go to schools that provide any opportunity.
Or a lot of them.
Virtually, you know, a lot of them. You know, of the young men, an enormous percentage of them. You know, the vast majority of them won't graduate from high school. And they will be involved in one point or another in the criminal justice system. And if you go to an integrated neighborhood, an integrated school system, you'll see nothing like that. A few blocks away at Southwest High School, where the 40% of the kids are non-white, you'll see almost nobody taking that path. Now, they may not all go to college. They may not all become PhDs, but they're going to find a path into the economy.
Well, if they want to get a PhD, they should talk to me first, and I'll try to convince them otherwise.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, these are really they're very different sets of opportunities for kids that go to integrated schools and segregated ones. Segregated schools are powerful pathways to prison.
So you don't think affordable housing is improving these areas? Or
I think that if you... I suspect it could be improving it in the palliative care sort of a way. You know, it could be
not the solution.
No, it's making the pain of those neighborhoods less severe. It's they make the physical structures for a short period of time less unattractive. But I think the forces that pull the neighborhoods apart are intact, and that they'll work. It has very little effect on people or on the neighborhoods, more than it's symbolic, it's important. There's sort of a broken windows theory of cities, you know. If you maintain...
Put some new paint on there.
Yeah, it maintains morale and all those kinds of things, which are not nothing. They're not trivial. But I think, you know, if the society has a limited number of dollars for affordable housing, and if it can build more units in an affluent neighborhood where the kids will do well, that's what it should do with those neighborhoods. Now, what will be the consequences to Franklin and Portland? Maybe some more abandonment, you know, maybe some more trouble. But the kids that are moving to Edina, you know, if we'd given the units to Edina, or if we'd given them to Mendota Heights, those kids would be in college. And now they're gonna be in jail. Sorry. I don't even know how this works. But I think by and large, you know, in the total picture, if you had to make a decision. Now, a person like me has never said, stop building units in those neighborhoods. Just don't build all of them there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I said the law says that you have to build 50% of them in the white areas.
Uh-huh. So one of the issues, at least in the debate with you and Professor Getz over at the Humphrey, which you're next to the Humphrey.
Yeah, I'm in the Humphrey. I'm on the faculty member there, too.
My office is the Social Science Tower. Okay, it's also... I feel like I could throw spitballs at you from my office.
Yeah. And we agree on many things.
Yeah.
We agree on exclusionary zoning. We agree on real estate steering, mortgage lending discrimination. We agree on fair share allocations. What we disagree on is whether there should be any priority on the placement of units. And he thinks that the central cities should get first priority. And I think that integration should have first priority.
He seemed to frame it, though, as an issue of choice for the theoretical resident of the affordable housing unit, that people don't want to live in Apple Valley.
Well, I think that there are some people that don't want to. Not everybody does. But the units in Apple Valley and Eden Prairie and Lakeville have the longest waiting lists. And the people that live in them are more than half non-white people. So there are lots and lots of people that do want to live there. Not everybody. And no one says everyone should have to. But there are many fewer choices for people to live in those places. I worked with a group of families in Eden Prairie, black families that were living in Eden Prairie, mostly African families. Mm-hmm. And I thought they were living out there because their jobs out there. But virtually none of the people that I met worked out there. They almost all worked around here. And they were living in Eden Prairie because the schools were good. Mm-hmm. And they had affordable housing there.
That's why most people live in Eden Prairie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the schools are good.
Yeah, and so it was really inconvenient for them. None of them had cars. They had a real hassle to get to work. But they wanted to live there. And any time a unit came open, they talked to somebody in their community to fill it. Huh. So, and, you know, I worked with a guy named Mark Alfers who builds housing in Dakota County. And he's got waiting lists that he has to close all the time, and his tenants are black and Latino people.
So you also
I think there's lots of people who want to live out there, and there are many fewer choices.
And I think it kind of it's interesting that it's sort of cultural in a sense. Like there are certain groups of immigrants or whoever that prefer certain spaces or seem to, and others that seem to prefer Shakopee or someplace.
Right.
I don't really know the details.
Well, it's part. I think these are complicated things, and you'd have to talk to John Adams or somebody, or, you know.
Yeah, I should talk to him.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, there's a new article. This came out today, actually, and it was by, I just got it today, Jennifer Dara and Stephanie DeLuca, and it's in the Journal of Policy Analysis and Management. And it's how people's preferences change. And it talks about, you know, Ed is really concerned with people that have lived in public housing all their lives, the poorest of the poor people. And a lot of times they don't want to move, and they are
really, they have multiple levels of disadvantage and trouble. But this article suggests that even those families who really don't like the suburbs, after they live out there a while, their opinions change and they start to see that it's important. They're just initially very resistant.
Yeah,
a lot of other more people that are less troubled and are less isolated from the economy are in the suburbs. You know, if you look at where do black people live now, more than half live in the suburbs. More than half of Latino people live in the suburbs. Where do black families that earn the median income live? 63% live in the suburbs. Where do black married families with children live? 77% live in the suburbs. People that have mobility, that have choices, that aren't in big trouble, want to live in places that have good schools and low crime. You know, everyone wants to live in Linden Hills, but Linden
Not
Hill,
me.
Yeah, I mean, or but I mean, you know,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but everyone wants to live in an urban setting that has is very convenient,
yes,
and super
yes.
white, and not super white, but super close in. And that's where, you know, Ed and I live in Linden Hills, and that's a nice place to live. But not how many people can afford to live there?
Yeah.
Linden Hills should have more affordable housing.
Yeah,
Linden Hills has great schools. You know, Linden Hills, all those kids are going.
They should
off.
Put a development on that famous Dave's site.
Yeah, they should. That's where it belongs. That's much better than the Phillips. That's where they should have built the Phillips Gateway.
Oh wow, good idea.
Yeah,
I could get behind
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there were some CDCs that are better and some that are worse in
yeah.
your opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think that CDCs will follow the rules, whatever they are. You know, I think that the, you know, Common Bond builds in the suburbs. Habitat for Humanity is built in the suburbs. Alan Arthur is putting his toe into the suburbs.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the point system is overwhelmingly geared toward the poor neighborhoods.
Who can change that? Is it the Met Council?
It's the State Housing Finance Agency.
Who's in charge of that?
Mary Tingerthal.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is she an appointee of Dayton?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a sad time. You'd thought, I would hope, you know, I'd always thought that the segregation was an artifact of conservative Republican governors and administrations. And it's sad to say that Pawlenty and Ventura were doing more to get integrated housing.
So you're telling me that George Romney's a good guy and that Pawlenty and Ventura are crusaders for racial integration?
No, George Romney was a good guy. And Pawlenty and Ventura were not so hot, but they're better than what's happening now.
Okay.
I was very disappointed in both of them at the time and said so, but I'm shocked at what's happening now. I thought that things might turn around when we had a Democratic governor,
yeah.
but they've turned the other way. They've put more emphasis on building the housing in poor neighborhoods. You know, we got 50%, we get periodically, when we're really doing well, we get 50% of these units into the suburbs, and now, you know, into the white suburbs. And now we've only got 18% in the white suburbs, and it's lower than it's ever been since we've been keeping track of it. And we want to put 4,000 units in Frogtown, which needs more affordable housing, like a hole in the head.
I think that the St. Paul really likes this, though. At least they think they do. Like the policy people that I've barely heard talk about, they're touting the new housing going up on University Avenue, and it's affordable. So people worried about gentrification are sort of assuaged, right?
Well, I mean, the only place that's really in danger of gentrification on the Central Corridor now is the areas around the university.
Yeah.
And there's no affordable housing going in there.
No, Dickeytown is amazingly expensive. I was
yeah,
always amazed
yeah.
by that.
They put up at 4,000 units in Frogtown, which even their own consultants say there's no evidence that there's any threat of gentrification in Frogtown. None.
No,
zero.
It'd be a good problem to have.
Yeah. Yeah, and a little bit of gentrification. A neighborhood like Frogtown needs it, but it's not going to get it, and it's certainly not going to get it if it has 4,000 more units of low-income subsidized housing. You know, and we've done this to North Minneapolis, we've done this to the near South Side, we've had generations of concentrating these units in poor neighborhoods. It hasn't had a good result. We set ourselves up for the foreclosure crisis by doing this. Had we behaved like we had been behaving, had we been like Portland and Seattle, our racial counterparts, that crisis would have been much less bad. It would not have been as devastating. It would have been bad. It was bad everywhere, but it would have been much less harmful.
Well, thanks for talking to me,
Myron.
Yeah. what should the Met Council do?
The Met Council should return to its good policy 39, which is still on the books. And the State Housing Finance Agency should revise its qualified allocation plan so that it's like New Jersey's or like Texas's, which are both pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Texas is better than us on this?
Texas just got sued, though, apparently.
Oh, good. Oh, you mean bad?
It got sued, so now it's got a good QAP because the federal court said their QAP was, violated the Fair Housing Act.
Okay.
But now it's a good one, and we should use it as a model.
Someone should sue the state?
Yeah. Well, I think it might happen. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Yes, I hope it was helpful.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. Again, consider joining Streets.mn if you appreciate this podcast or any of the Streets.mn content. If you have any feedback or ideas about what to do to improve this or some good guest thoughts, you can comment on Streets.mn, on Twitter at Streets.mn, or you can email me at blindicke@gmail.com.